Live from Chicago, this is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont this evening with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our distinguished panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, we've got commentary from Mike Miller of DePaul University, John McDonough of Northwestern, John McGovern of Resolute Consulting, and Dave Lundy of Aileron Consulting. Our program coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications Radio Studio in Chicago's beautiful River North neighborhood. Welcome once again. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, who's a bit under the weather, and we hope he feels better very, very soon. But thank you for joining us, whether you are watching us on TV or listening on a regular radio station or satellite radio. We're happy to have you with us. Let's get right to one of the main topics for this upcoming week in national politics and government. Dave Lundy, what will happen in the United States Senate? Are we going to see a government shutdown, or are we going to see some kind of accommodation for both the Republican position and the funding of Obamacare?
I actually am a real pessimist on this. I think the mechanisms in our politics are breaking down. I think that the Ted Cruz and his ilk in the Republican Party are so determined to fixate on defunding Obamacare that we're going to have a government shutdown. And I think Republicans like John McCain are advising against it. Many other Republicans who remember what happened last time Newt Gingrich did this are advising strongly against this, using words like kamikaze mission and, you know, completely suicidal. And they're right. This would be a debacle of monumental proportions if they do this, and I'm looking forward to seeing what they do.
Mike Miller of DePaul University, is it going to be funding for Obamacare or running the federal government?
I think what's going to happen is they're going to come up to some kind of an agreement that maybe postpones Obamacare for a year. That will be the in-between, because the Senate's not going to pass what was sent to them. And so they're going to send it back to the House, and something's going to have to be done. I think a lot of Americans are very upset with Obamacare. Personally, I have members of my family. We don't know what's going to happen October 1st. Here we are in Illinois, 10 days before the end of the month. We have no idea what the policy is going to be, what's available, what the premiums are going to be. We know nothing. And that kind of upset, and they've already given these benefits to the corporations. The thing to do is not shut down the government. I think that would be, even as a Republican, it's a mistake. But they've got to do something about Obamacare. It's a train wreck.
John McDonough, Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who's been leading the defund Obamacare campaign such as it is, said today he doesn't want to see the government shut down and he doesn't want to see Obamacare funded. And he points out that the way the House sent the bill over to the Senate, it's now in the hands of Harry Reid and President Obama whether or not they want to shut down the federal government. Do you take it that way?
Well, that's preposterous. I think, you know, Cruz and his allies have really painted themselves into a kind of corner because they have gotten to the point now where any reasonable accommodation on their part with Obamacare is going to, I mean, they've said it. It'll be considered surrender. And when you get to the point in this government when doing business with the opposition is considered surrender, I mean, I agree with Dave. It's not a pretty picture. And so I think they've raised expectations of their base to the point where they've really put themselves in a very difficult position.
John McDonough, with your experience at the United States House of Representatives, working for a former Speaker of the United States House.
I'm John McDonough.
I'm sorry, John.
I'm McGovern. McDonough.
You got too many Johns and too many Mix.
The law firm of McDonough and McGovern is here tonight.
I put my
well
on
represented.
That one.
Thank you. Yes. John McGovern, with your background working in the U.S. House of Representatives for a Speaker, how do you see the events of this week playing out now that the U.S. House has sent a bill to the Senate that is very clear about running the government except for Obamacare?
Well, I think it's going to I'm a little more optimistic that they're going to work this out. And I think it's setting this up to have what I think is a healthy debate about Obamacare. And I agree with what Mike said. I mean, we've already delayed it for corporations. We've given an exception to members of Congress and their staffs. Clearly, there's a lot of problems with this. And I think it deserves some further discussion about how to implement it. And frankly, I think the worst part of the whole thing is we had a president who called the Speaker of the House yesterday or Friday and said, I'm not going to negotiate with you. He was talking about the debt ceiling. But the idea that the White House is refusing to have a conversation with anyone, I think, shows an incredible lack of leadership. And, you know, it's like, you know, the Republicans have a point. I think they should have a debate about it. We should have a conversation about it. But people need to come and have a conversation in good faith at the table about it.
Dave Lundy, the president wants to negotiate with Vladimir Putin. He wants to negotiate with Bashar Assad, but he won't talk to John Boehner. And the administration is granting all of these exceptions. How do you square that circle?
Okay, first of all, the president talks to John Boehner with some regularity, so I think that that's a red herring. But I actually want to go back to something that
Wait. They do. The president has announced a no negotiation policy
on the debt limit. On the debt limit. That's a different issue. The president has said we're not a deadbeat nation. We're going to pay our bills, and I'm not going to be held hostage by a bunch of folks in Congress who are saying I'm going to shut down the government and threaten the United States credit rating unless you defund a policy that, by the way, we had an election in 2012. Yeah, and last I checked, the president won overwhelmingly and Obamacare was front and center. But I want to go back to something that John McGovern said. I got that one.
It was McGovern.
Which is, you said we should have a discussion about the implementation of Obamacare. And if the discussion is about the implementation of Obamacare, which has been done about other policies, other major policies, I think that the president would be very happy to have that discussion. The problem is what he's being approached with is an opposition that is not saying let's discuss how we implement and where we do certain things. He's being presented with an opposition that's saying I'm going to shut the government down unless you defund a law that is the law of the land that we had a national election talking about.
Well, I don't think that...
And this is also the guy who has changed this law like he's the king.
Right.
All of a sudden he says, oh, I don't think you need to do it, even though the law says this. He has no power to do that.
No.
I agree with you. Implementation is the key. That's why I think it's going to come back to that. And we're going to recognize the train wreck that Democrats have talked about, and we're going to push it away for
a
year.
It's called a train wreck. Sean Hannity has been calling it a train wreck for the last year, and the train hasn't even left the station yet. I'll tell you.
Max Baucus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee and one of the principal sponsors for Obamacare in the Senate, he called it a train wreck.
That's exactly
as well,
right.
John.
But it's still sitting in the station. It hasn't moved yet.
So
that's
just rhetoric. Let's just concede that's rhetoric.
What's going on in the economy in terms of what's going on with employers, what's going on with cutting people's hours back, with people cutting back jobs because they don't have to pay for benefits and they don't want to have to pay these health care costs?
That's not new. This is not new. This has been going on with employers for decades.
It's been going on for a year.
Wait a minute. So, David, let me just ask you,
and John McDonough, is it your position that Obamacare should be funded as is, or do you believe that these exemptions that have been granted recently indicate that there are some problems that have got to be worked out? And we're getting close to the minute here.
There's clearly implementation issues, as there is with any major new policy. And I would love to talk about the details maybe after the break.
John McDonough, does that do it for you?
I don't know enough about the exemptions, really, to talk intelligently about that. So.
It's Beyond the Beltway. I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, and we're glad you're with us. We're going to be back after the break. More on Obamacare and what's happening in national politics and global affairs. Good evening. This is Chris Roebling sitting in for the ailing Bruce Dumont. We hope he gets better and comes back real soon. Thanks for joining us on Beyond the Beltway, where we've got a great conversation going on about Obamacare, the federal government, and whether or not things are going to get shut down. It really is all in the United States Senate this week. John McGovern, the U.S. Senate, what are the dynamics over there between, say, Ted Cruz, who is a freshman member of a minority party, and his own party structure, which we hear is pretty upset with Ted Cruz, Mike Lee, and some of the other conservatives who have led this charge, and then the majority structure, which, of course, is led by Harry Reid, Senate Majority Leader.
Well, I mean, that's a complicated question, obviously, but I think you're right. I think there are some people who are unhappy with Mike Lee and Ted Cruz. But, you know, these are young, new freshman senators. They represent a different attitude, a different part of the party, and they're making their voice heard. And I think they represent, obviously, a lot of people who feel the same way. And I think they have a position that deserves to be considered. And it was interesting today what Ted Cruz said. He said that they should filibuster the bill when it comes over. They should get 41 votes to filibuster because, as we were talking about earlier, if it comes over and Reid gets it, he can strip out the defunding of Obamacare and then pass it.
Right.
So now Senator Cruz's proposed tactic is when the bill comes over to have the Republicans actually filibuster the House bill in order to keep Reid from being able to get it out. He, of course, would need 41 votes for that. I don't think it's clear right now that he has enough of his own colleagues, but...
And John McDonough, would you agree, at the very least, that when Ted Cruz campaigned for election last year, he campaigned in Chicago.
Yep.
I think we were privileged to meet him at that time.
Even though he's running in Texas, he campaigned
fundraising
money
all over the country. And he said then, if I'm elected, I will do everything I can to defund Obamacare. And he was elected on that program.
So do you
grant him that?
What I don't grant is why so many people are listening to him, though. He's a freshman senator. This is his first year or two in the Senate. What is his game that he is able to suck so much oxygen out of the debate, you know, to himself?
You know, I think the point about a freshman, though, is, you know, there's a lot of disgust with the way government runs now, especially with Congress.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't think there's necessarily it's a bad thing to have a freshman with a large voice, because a lot of people are disappointed with the people that have been there a very long time.
But the price he's paying is that nobody takes him seriously as a legislator.
I have to say, I mean,
Barack Obama. You're talking about Barack?
Let's just talk about a fact here. He made the point today, and I think that this is a fair point. 6-8 weeks ago, no one expected the United States House of Representatives to pass a bill that was so clean about defunding Obamacare. Most people said, Ted, you're in a flight of fancy. This is just not going to go anywhere, because we all know that Harry Reid and President Obama are going to protect Obamacare. But he's now actually got this House bill. So Dave Lundy, is he representing these ongoing national polls of both sides and of independent news organizations that Obamacare is itself still very deeply unpopular?
Well, first of all, he's representing the whatever spirits he has in his own mind that have determined that the key to becoming a credible presidential candidate in 2016 is to take on the mantle of the Tea Party, and the defund Obamacare is the vanguard of the Tea Party. Ted Cruz is a very talented politician. He's very talented. He's very capable. He's a little bit scary, but if he keeps on this front, he'll get a lot of energy. It'll be fun to watch him and Rand Paul fight it out for the Tea Party mantle. But it doesn't change the fact we have to fund the government. Shutting down the government means that you're not funding Social Security. It means that you're not funding the military. It means that you're not paying, you know, everybody
That's
gets all
not
the money.
Necessarily
but
isn't what it means.
But let's
That's
turn to Mike
means.
Here.
Shutting down the government?
For a second. Let's turn to Mike,
Those
the economist.
Payments continue.
Do you buy, John McDonough said he doesn't buy this, but do you buy this point that they are now making? The way John Boehner in the House positioned this spending measure, the government goes on, but for Obamacare.
Mm-hmm.
Is that going to get out to the troops? Is that going to get out to the neighborhoods?
It is, but it's a terrible tactic. I just think it's a mistake.
Okay.
But, you know, whenever you negotiate, at least I would think this is the way I would do it, I would always ask for more than I know that I'm going to end up with. So maybe they've asked for the moon here, and they're not going to get it, because even if they defund it, they're only defunding 20% of Obamacare. The other 80% is not discretionary. It has to be spent. why couldn't they have this fallback then? Okay, let's sit down and talk. See, I don't think there's any talking
but
going
that goes
on.
Back
I do
to
think
my
that the government
earlier
is broken.
Point about, you know, this whole they haven't left themselves any fallback position. If they fall back a centimeter, they've surrendered.
But if they push it away for a year, that means we don't
that's
have
not gonna,
it.
That's not
that,
happen.
What
that's,
makes you think
puts
that's
it
not
right,
going
that
to
puts
happen?
It right
it's
on the threshold of the next
happened.
Election
for corporations.
Look, it's not no. Look. It's not going to happen because you have exchanges all over this country that are moving forward aggressively. That are finding that when they get competition, healthcare rates are dropping, just like the Heritage Foundation and Newt Gingrich said it would back in 1993 when they came up with this idea.
They don't even
actually
know
working around the country.
This is something affecting directly my family and. I see that, for example, if you ask for a subsidy, they can't check. You can lie through your teeth to get a subsidy because they're not going to check for another year. What kind of system
and
is that?
And why did they not
secondly,
check?
Here
was
we
that
are,
because of
ten,
the Republican rule? That, it's
no.
Because the Republicans insisted because the IRS has no power in order to regulate Obamacare.
They don't even know how to set the premiums. They don't have the software necessary in Illinois to set the premiums. Here we are 10 days away from when we're supposed to apply for this, and we can't do it because we don't have any idea what programs are available, what the premiums are going to be. And keep in mind, these are people's health care.
John,
so
wait, let
you
me
think
ask,
it is so important.
Let me bring David's point to you, John, as somebody who had to work with members of Congress. And you had to listen to them expressing to you their concerns about what they heard from their voters and their constituents back home. Does the Republican Party in Congress, House or Senate, bear responsibility for the implementation sort of potholes and roadblocks that have been encountered by the Obama administration?
Well, no. I mean, first of all, it's not the Republican Congress that passed this law. It was the Democrats. Second,
zero votes for
right.
Republicans.
Secondly, you know, I think it's rather extraordinary what happened the other day with Speaker Boehner and the conference, that there was almost unanimity about this, and they had two Democrats who joined with them. They're obviously reflecting what they're hearing from their constituents back home. Think of the timing of where we are. We're right after Labor Day. They've spent a month, mm-hmm. the month of August, at home, attending events, being in parades, talking to constituents. It's very fresh on their minds what their own constituents are telling them. So I think that is reflected in this bill.
And John McDonnell, let me ask you, what about this theory that there are Democrats who were coming up for re-election to the U.S. Senate in states that were carried by Mitt Romney? Okay, mm-hmm. So these are the so-called red state Democrat senators. Yeah. Aren't they going to take a look? They're going to listen to this tape and they're going to hear Professor Mike over here saying these things about postponing it for a year. Aren't they going to say that's a good idea for me because I have to face the voters next November?
I don't think that could possibly happen because it would force it would present us with an election in which this whole issue is going to be relitigated once again, just like it was when it first passed. And I don't know that the country has an appetite for that. I think one of the reasons, though, that the polls keep showing that Obamacare is so unpopular is that this is taking place in the midst of a propaganda war in which the pro healthcare people have really hardly raised their sword yet.
The pro healthcare people?
The White House has failed.
Right. Well, the White House has failed?
The White House
but
has failed.
But aren't you saying the president has failed because he's spoken more than 50 times on Obamacare?
Oh, that's
it's more than just the president. Yeah.
The president and more people have failed.
No, the community. Look, after they passed Obamacare,
yes.
They dropped the messaging on Obamacare. They went on to other things. You know, they're busy people. Whatever.
Highway bill, whatever.
Yeah, whatever it is. Yeah. And the other side didn't. The other side kept going and going about how terrible Obamacare was.
Are you accusing the Republicans of actually communicating well?
They were effective on this. They were very effective on this.
I think you can't blame or you can't define poor policy by poor communications. I mean, that's just, you know, how you communicate something is one thing, but the substance is what's getting people angry.
But when you ask people, that's not true.
When you
poll people on the individual components of Obamacare, it is popular.
But that's
very
individual
pieces.
And they have
done surveys of businessmen, small business. Dave, you're in the small business. And one thing they say about hiring is that they're concerned what it's going to cost them in terms of the benefits for their new employees. How many employees are going down to 29 hours from 35 or 40? How many employees are not being hired because of the expense that could be implied? Enormous effects upon the economy.
I am one of those small employers.
I understand
that. Let me tell you why this is good for a small business person, and I've talked to a lot of other small business people who say the exact same thing.
You have less than 1 minute.
It is good for small business people because I can go for my employees and have them go into a competitive exchange. They're not paying through the nose the way that we would when we tried to get a small health care plan. They have an exchange. They have a marketplace, and I can subsidize their health care just the way I would if I had my own plan, except they have a competitive market to do it in. Their costs are going to be lower. My costs are going to be lower. And they're not going to have to worry about pre-existing conditions. It is incredibly compelling.
If we had implemented something like that to the entire program, it would have been much better. Take it away from my employer and let us all do that. Let us buy across state lines. Let's create the competition. This is something Republicans have wanted for years, and what we got instead was Obamacare, this government-centered as opposed to market-centered outcome.
John,
I agree. Everything you describe is wonderful.
John McDonough, is this going to come? Is this a week from tonight? Will the people at this table be saying that this was a week for the Democrats in the Senate or the Republicans?
A week from this, I don't know. When's the?
A lot of it is going to happen this week.
What's next Wednesday? It's the October what?
It's
October 1st is the start of the new fiscal year. Next Sunday.
We're going to have to. We'll find out from John and everybody else right after these words. Good evening. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. No, your TV is not lying to you. I just want to say it's a privilege to be here on Bruce's behalf, and he's taking the night off, and we hope to see him back soon. Time now for the self-introductions that Bruce has introduced to the program in the last couple of months. Mike Miller of DePaul University.
I'm an economist. I've been there for 33 years, and I have the privilege of teaching economics to young minds, one of the most fulfilling things you could possibly do.
Fantastic. John McDonough of Northwestern.
Well, Northwestern, I'm an independent producer for National Public Radio, and worked with Walter Cronkite, Bob Trout, and many pieces in the past, and also at Northwestern in an unrelated field, the music department.
John McGovern of Resolute Consulting.
I'm an attorney and an executive vice president with Resolute Consulting, which is a national public affairs firm. And I spent 8 years working for Dennis Hastert, who was Speaker of the House last decade.
Dave Lundy, Aileron Communications.
I'm a recovered lawyer. My firm does clean energy communications and also works with technology companies. I have two young sons, Eli and Max.
I keep meaning
to say hi to them on the air. Today I've done so.
Fantastic. Eli and Max, hello. I want to get a couple of calls in here real quick, and then we're going to go to a quote that President Obama gave us earlier this week. Ted, Bradley, Illinois, listening to us on WLS, please join us with your bottom line point.
Yeah, I don't remember who the gentleman was, but I heard someone say something in regards to Ted Cruz voicing his opinion, even though he's a freshman senator. I think that the people that elected him there want him to voice his opinion. I mean, he understands what they sent him to Washington for, and if his opinion is that we need to fund this thing, it's his right to say so on behalf of his constituents.
Thank you, Ted of Illinois, standing up for Ted Cruz of Texas. John McDonough?
All I can say is the Senate is an ancient institution with many protocols and traditions that it takes very seriously. And listening to a freshman senator pontificate on major national issues before a national audience is not something they take lightly and easily.
Brenda of Redding, California, is listening on the great KQMS. Brenda, your bottom line point, please, for the panel.
I'm on SSI. My daughter has to work 3 part-time jobs because she can't get a full-time job anymore. And I would love to see the Senate grow a backbone and defund Obamacare.
All right. Thank you very much, Brenda. Dave Lundy.
Can I ask Brenda a question?
I think Brenda's gone, but you can talk to her right now and everybody else in the country.
I would be interested to know if how old her daughter is, if her daughter is 27 or below, that means she's probably on her mom's policy, thanks to Obamacare. If she's not and she wants to get health care on her own, she can now go into an exchange and get it thanks to Obamacare. This will be very good for Brenda's daughter in all likelihood, particularly if there are any pre-existing conditions whatsoever.
That's Dave Lundy's opinion. Joanne in Schaumburg, listening on WLSAM, our flagship station. Your bottom line point, please.
Hi, Chris. I just want to make a point to your one guest tonight who's saying this has been going on for decades. When this passed, the majority of the parents opposed it. Today, the majority of the parents oppose Obamacare. The unions are opposing it. Walgreens has laid off 160,000, not laid off, but dropped the insurance for 160,000 employees this week. UPS is dropping coverage for spouses. IBM and GE are dropping coverage for retirees. And Rahm Emanuel is putting the Citi retirees on the exchanges. We don't want this in our country. We don't want to have to go to part-time jobs because employers don't want to have to put up with Obamacare. And that's what is happening.
Now, John McGovern, you hear Joanne, and she makes such a clear argument. We didn't exactly hear that this morning on the Sunday talk shows from the Republicans, did we?
Well, I mean, she makes a very compelling argument. It's one that Mike and I have been talking about here on this show today. And, you know, I just say to Dave, you know, the story we heard from the caller before, you know, we're living in a very difficult economy on top of all the issues we're discussing about Obamacare. Someone who's working three jobs is having a hard time in this economy, in the Obama economy, trying to find a real stable job. You know, they may be able to get access to insurance now, but they may not be able to afford it. I mean, if you're working three part-time jobs, you're struggling, you're trying to make ends meet, and now you have to go and you have a mandate to buy insurance that maybe, you know, you may not be able to afford
it. And if you're struggling to afford it, there are significant federal subsidies to help you ensure that you can get that insurance.
Also, keep in mind that the president promised that there would be no change. If you liked what you have, right, you can keep it. Tell that to the 160,000 people at Walgreens. Right. And since, tell it to me. The university has just told us this week, because we will, the quality of our plan in 5 years or 4 years is going to be too high, and they're going to tax us, so we've got to change what you have.
Now, does this cause David and John to rethink the position about modifying the program?
It doesn't cause me to rethink it, because I've worked for large corporations in the past, and my experience has been when the corporation changes insurers, that's a whole new deck that's reshuffled to all the employees, and they cannot necessarily keep the doctor they've been going to. They have to go.
We could, though. Just keep that in mind.
And they have to go with the the policy and the healthcare
You were told you can keep the insurance, but guess what? Odds are, if your employer is like other employers, like John is talking about, your employer may have switched insurance five times in the last 10 years.
Yeah, so
okay, well, that's a different situation. Yeah. And maybe there are exceptions. But again, this gets back to exactly what John McGovern said early in this program, yes, which is implementation issues. If there are specific implementation issues that need to be worked on, they should be worked on. You know, look, this notion that a law is completely fully baked and there's never any problems that happen after you pass the law is insane. That's not how things work.
But you don't allow,
Mike, in Illinois, we call them trailer bills, okay? And trailer bills are there to clean up legislation where there are mistakes or issues.
There's a difference between the technical
correction
and the
technical
fix.
Well, as you know, trailer bills aren't about technical corrections either.
Hold on 1 second, guys. Chris of Elkhart, Indiana, I know you've got a bottom line point for the panel. Please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Hey, if I had a brand new Cadillac to sell you for $5,000, would you buy it? Of course you would. If you knew that I was lying to you, would you buy it? Of course you would know that I'm lying to you. That's exactly what Obama did to those of us in this country. He sold us. One of your panelists talked about him being reelected on the premise of Obamacare. He lied to us under those premises of Obamacare. He lied to us on the reasons for Obamacare, and now you're seeing the effects of it. That's why so many of us out here in the country, in flyover country, want them to shut down the government. I'm fine with it. Hold my Social Security check if you want to. Fight for this. It's not right. He lied to us on very initial premises.
How did he lie?
Chris, go ahead. Dave Lundy asks, how did President Obama lie?
Many people can't keep their doctors. Many people are – the $2,500 that he said the families would save are already ate up in red tape by government programs. Right now, I'm being forced off my insurance because of Obamacare. I'm having to go down to part-time, as a matter of fact. So, consequently, those things that he promised would not happen are happening, and I see you can tell throughout the country how many people are upset by this, by the very things he promised would not happen. He sold Obamacare to us on lies. He bold-faced lies. He said many times, but while flying the country and giving his speeches day after day, week after week. And now, you know, those chickens are coming home to roost.
All right.
Those of us here, we want the government to shut down, fight for this. It's not right.
Chris of Elkhart, listening on WTRC. Thank you very much for calling in. Let me just ask you about this. I mean, I think there is a flavor of this is unlike any other implementation. I think there is a flavor of I happened to be sitting in for Bruce actually on the very night that it passed, and we had the Beyond the Beltway's first all female panel except for me, and it was a historic evening. Okay, but we all know that it was sort of power politics and the Democrats. There were no Republicans who were supporting it. There was a lot of parliamentary back and forth. But let's just say, let's grant it the stature of it being an actual act of Congress. Don't we all sense that this thing has failed to find a constituency,
mm-hmm.
and that is a big national program? It is remaining something of an open question about how it's going to work, who it's going to help, and who it's going to hurt.
I remember when it passed, and Speaker Pelosi got the lectern, and she said essentially that this was going to be a major breakthrough for entrepreneurs and that jobs were going to explode in this country because of Obamacare. And I'm shaking my head thinking, what is exactly going on in Europe where they already have something like this or beyond, where their economies are stagnant? And here we are 4 years later or 3 years later, and the economy is in the worst recovery in the history of the country since even beyond the Great Depression. It's the worst recovery ever. Where are all those jobs? I'm convinced that some of the weakness in jobs is because of the uncertainty created both by Obamacare as well as by the government. And San Francisco Fed did some research and concluded that unemployment is probably one full percentage point higher because of the uncertainty in Washington. Now, part of it's the battle, but part of that is Obamacare that's creating this uncertainty.
Dave, where is the constituency?
Well, I thought I was going to answer Mike's question.
Oh, go ahead. I think that's
I actually equivalent. Think that I'm not surprised at all by that finding that 1% lower of GDP, but
unemployment.
But that again is because of this insane situation in Washington where the Republicans in the House have voted 41 right. times. 41 times to defund Obamacare and zero times on the president's jobs bill, when all kinds of economists are saying, look, interest rates are low, we can borrow money low, we can put people to work, we can do it immediately. And again, over and over and over again, it's rejected.
If just the government would spend some money, there would be this, right. this rise in GDP.
Because we have no infrastructure
issues. The effect of that kind of spending is near zero at this point in the business cycle. That's what the research shows clearly.
John McGovern.
Yeah, and you know the other thing former Speaker Pelosi said on one of the shows this morning, you know, we're talking about this frustration with the amount of money and the debt that this country has, the amount of money that's spent and the debt. And she said today, well, there's no more money to cut. And that's the mentality mm-hmm. of Democrats in Congress. And frankly, you know, to blame all of this on the Republicans isn't entirely fair. And, you know, I think you made a very interesting point, Dave, earlier when you said the White House has failed and the president has failed to lead in the sense that he has failed to go to the Hill and advocate for his policies, whether it's jobs or whatever else.
We're coming back. That was John McGovern. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. We're coming back after the break to talk specifically about how Obamacare and the debt limit increase have become enmeshed with each other, and we'll start with John McDonough. Good evening. This is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, and we're coming to the close of our television program. But everybody listening on radio, you can keep listening for another hour after this one. I want to start this segment with a quote from President Obama when he met with the Business Roundtable this week. And let's put that up on the screen so we can take a quick look. You have never seen in the history of the United States the debt ceiling or the threat of not raising the debt being used to extort a president or a governing party and trying to force issues that have nothing to do with the budget and nothing to do with the debt. That was President Obama on Wednesday, the 18th of September. John McDonough, your reaction to the confluence of the debt ceiling issue and these budget issues represented by the fight over Obamacare?
Well, I believe the Washington Post kind of called him on the accuracy of that remark, but I haven't looked into it independently. I intended to, but I didn't have time. So, so I can't offer too much in the way of – I'll have to let the Washington Post speak for me on that. But I think the one thing that we really should do, and you pointed it out earlier, is separate the government shutdown issue from the raising the debt ceiling.
Two
entirely separate issues. They happen to be, as you suggested, coming into a kind of confluence at in a synchronous moment, but they are quite separate, and they have nothing to do with each other except for the fact that they are both being a kind of tied to Obamacare.
All right, John McGovern, because of your background on the Hill, I want to ask you if you'll define for the listeners all over the country something that you and I know very well called a must-pass bill. Can you tell us what a must-pass bill is?
I think it's self-explanatory, Chris. I think all our listeners know what that means. To John McDonough's point, I just pulled up the Washington Post here, and it was September 19th. They gave four Pinocchios to that comment. So I don't know whether we want to call that an outright lie or misleading or what. But
it was sort of a mischaracterization of history.
Very much a mischaracterization.
But how does that relate to what we're going to see this week?
Well, I think, you know, as we're talking about, I think it's and we were talking a little bit about this off air as well, is that it's interesting that these two, that the defunding of Obamacare and the debt ceiling have sort of morphed almost into a joint debate about the two issues. And they are obviously quite separate in many ways. But I think it informs the idea. One of the problems with Obamacare, I think a lot of people are upset about the cost. And I think when you look at the debt ceiling, and once again, you know, we had this debate about a year ago about, you know, should the Congress authorize the president to continue to borrow more money without having some accountability on bringing the budget down or bringing some budget cuts in line. And those two things are coming together because I think that's, you know, this is a fiscal issue. But, you know, the idea that the president will say, I refuse to have a conversation with anybody about this, to call it to use the term in that quote was extortion.
Right.
When the Congress is doing in its wisdom its job by evaluating this issue and providing their advice, if you will.
But my understanding is Congress has already voted and appropriated the money. So what's to be negotiated?
Well, because the idea is, you know, the money's been appropriated, but.
The credit card
you can only
limit.
Spend so much.
Okay.
And the idea to just continually up the ante on it to allow the deficit to continue to grow.
But my understanding, this isn't for future expenditures. This is for past.
That's a lie.
Yeah. Well, the deficit is large. It's just not growing. It's falling.
No, the deficit has been cut more than in half. The deficit is now. The deficit was more than
$1.5 trillion.
Yeah, I mean,
no, the deficit was very large as a percentage of GDP. Yeah. It is now very small as a percentage of GDP.
Not small.
I don't think
very
it's
much.
4%.
No, the deficit is heading towards.
Well, you're talking to an economist. It's not small.
More than half the size it was.
But if it was extremely
and you know
large,
what, though,
that doesn't...
The average person out there who's having trouble in this economy making ends meet, they understand what it is to spend when people spend money they don't have. And that's what the government is
doing. I think we can... David, I want you to respond to that. I think we can agree that there are two sides to this issue. One is sort of a government can grow without negative influence or negative consequence to the economy. Other people are saying the economy is being held back by the government growth we've already seen. Do you have any concern that whereas that didn't come up against President Obama in the reelection, is that debate going against Democrats as you head into 2014?
I think that debate, the debate over how is the government spending money, what is the trajectory of the deficit, where is the spending being cut, where is the spending being invested, is a debate that Democrats should welcome. They should take it enthusiastically, and they.
But if so, where are President Obama's proposals on making the deficit or the spending structure come into line?
First of all, we were heading in that direction. The CBO said
no. The CBO made it perfectly clear that on the trajectory we are on, based upon Medicare and Social Security, the deficit will get smaller for another year or two. And I agree, it is half what it was, but it is still over 4% of GDP, which is relatively high. It was 1.1% before this recession began. But it
actually,
is,
there was a surplus before George Bush took us into two wars, but that's neither here nor
we
there.
Also, we also had, I just
also
want to say,
a recession, which always leads to a reset to the a budget deficit, which is what you would want to have happen.
And, exactly.
And I want to thank
so
that.
Don't tell me that was a bad thing.
That was Mike Miller of DePaul University talking to Dave Lundy of Aileron Communications. We also thank John McGovern of Resolute Consulting and John McDonough of Northwestern University for our first hour of conversation on the radio or our program if you're watching us on TV. I'm Chris Roebling, and I am sitting in for Bruce Dumont this evening, and we appreciate your viewership or your listenership. Please stand by. We'll be back on radio, and if you're watching on TV, see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont with our second hour of Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo. Ladies and gentlemen, an all-star lineup this evening on the panel for your listening enjoyment. Mike Miller of DePaul University, John McGovern of Resolute Consulting, John McDonough of Northwestern University, and Dave Lundy of Aileron Communications. Our toll-free lines are open. We want to hear from you. That's 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. We have been talking about the possibility of a government shutdown, questions about increasing the debt limit for the United States government, and what will happen to Obamacare. We're going to talk one more segment about that before getting to international news. And I've got some great callers who've been waiting. Let's get right to Jeff of Austin, Texas, listening on KLBJ. Jeff, your bottom line point for the panel, please.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. The Max Baucus quote that's being thrown around so often is out of context, and it's really important to understand that he didn't say that Obamacare is already a train wreck at all. He said, if not enough money is spent promoting properly, it will be a train wreck. And, of course, the Republicans are doing everything they can to make sure that this isn't advertised. Governor Perry in Texas is going to extraordinary lengths to prevent word getting out to the people that need it most about how they can be helped by Obamacare.
All right, Jeff, if you're in Texas, tell us your view of Senator Ted Cruz, your freshman member of the United States Senate.
He's a very talented speaker. He's a very skilled politician. He's a loudmouth blowhard who will do say anything to further his own career, even at the expense of incredible damage long-term to the Republican Party. And I think that his colors showed last week when the House sent a bill to the Senate that did exactly what he requested. And while they were still voting on it, he sent out a press release saying, well, it doesn't look like we're going to be able to, you know, pass this in the Senate, so it's back to you in the House. And then after outrage on Republican colleagues' part in the House, he finally said, oh, I'll try to filibuster. And to your guest who said earlier that he didn't know if there were 41 votes on his side, let me tell you, yes, you do know. Everyone knows there aren't 41 votes because even Cruz's colleagues are fed up with him.
All right, that's Jeff of Austin, Texas. Thanks so much for calling in. Dan of Mount Prospect, Illinois, listening on WLS, our flagship station. Please, your bottom line point for the panel.
Right. Thanks for the taking my call. Mine isn't political. It's just information-wise. What exactly is the exemption that these organizations and companies have received? I have my own company. And if you do get the exemption from the Affordable Care Act, how long does it last?
Well, I think that's an in-depth policy question. I'm not sure we're up to answering with great specificity. Dave Lundy, how do you explain the phenomenon of these exemptions? And thank you, Dan, for calling in very much.
I think there's a question about where the line is drawn. And this is exactly the point that Mike was making earlier, the challenge that they're having with their self-funded insurance plan, which is, you know, part of Obamacare said that there's a level beyond which you are subject to taxation on your plan, what are the quote-unquote
40%.
Cadillac plans, right. a pretty meaningful tax. In other words, the benefit, you get taxed on the benefit that you receive, just like you're taxed on income. And so a lot of companies are trying to get exemptions from that policy. There was a question in Congress where Congress wanted to say, well, we should be, I think somebody said they wanted to not be allowed to subsidize Obamacare if other people couldn't subsidize Obamacare. There have been a lot of stories. The White House just said no to the unions about a week ago, said, I'm sorry, but this is a benefit and it is subject to taxation.
We've got there's tape of Rich Trumka, the head of the AFL-CIO, railing against the implementation of Obamacare.
And the caller said essentially that the Republicans are to blame for what's going on here and that we just don't give enough money. That's what my understanding is. Not money is not the issue. There's not enough software. The software is not ready to go to determine what the premiums are going to be. The software is not there to determine what the income limits are and so forth so that people know whether or not they pass in terms of getting the government subsidies. And nothing is in place. Here we are literally weeks before this is going
to
happen.
Actually, I need to address this because I had this conversation with somebody who's involved in implementation of Obamacare here in Illinois on this very issue that you're describing. Number one, a lot of what you're saying is not accurate. What is not in place – no, listen. What is not in place, they have not announced the cost for these insurance plans.
They're going to but a week ago going, and they didn't.
You're right.
They're hiding something is what I'm guessing.
Well, whether they're hiding something or they just aren't ready to announce it, it's going to be announced October 1st. And the point that this individual made was, you know, how many times do you buy something and 3.5 months, you know, you didn't know the price 3.5 months out, it's terrible, but you know the price 3 months out and it's not a problem. I mean, we're going to know what these amounts are. And for the record,
like
the states that have taken this seriously and have taken their mandates seriously, like New York and Oregon and California, are finding that, number one, the insurance exchanges are working incredibly well, and the cost of the plans are coming in dramatically below what was expected.
The New York and the California experiences are distinguished, okay, by the fact that they had so increased mandates on all providers in those locations that it was impossible for the new plan not to see reductions in prices. But I want to ask you if this issue of the exemptions, if that indicates anything other than a fundamental weakness, and we can go back 2.5 years to the serial granting of exemptions to people who had contributed to Nancy Pelosi and who did business with Nancy Pelosi's husband. And then you have these massive exemptions that are sought and given to big corporations. Then they're sought and given to big labor. Isn't there somewhere in this a red flag for the rest of us who don't have the kind of special interest status of Nancy Pelosi fundraiser or big corporation or big labor? John McDonough?
That I can't accept entirely the veracity of that accusation. That comes so close to bold-faced bribery.
Nancy Pelosi, I don't know if it ended up between 30, I believe it ends up between 30 and 50
individual units
that are related to her district and her political office, mm-hmm. or to her husband. I mean, I don't know if it's 43 or 32, whatever it was.
It was more than a couple.
Yeah, I mean, there were several dozen.
Well, was it because they contributed to her campaign, or were there other extenuating circumstances?
Nobody stood up and said, because I contributed to her campaign, I got this exemption. I'm asking you the bigger question. What weakness of Obamacare precipitates this kind of activity by Richard Trumka?
Well, he sort of said, we supported your campaign and you owe us this. I mean, that was his argument, as I recall.
He's the head of the AFL-CIO, for listeners who don't know.
And I think they'd like to get rid of it. Didn't he say that he'd was it him or Hoffa? One of the two said, like to get
Hoffa,
rid of it.
Hoffa was
I think what has happened here, I honestly think that what we have an implication here of the president's domestic agenda. And I think in the next segment, we've got to start talking about his foreign agenda and what's going on there. But he is not playing to a chorus of univocal support. That's one of the weaknesses that Ted Cruz is exploiting at this point. It's Chris Roebling in for Bruce Dumont, and we'll be chatting with the panel and with you on your phone calls after these words. Sunday night, and this is Beyond the Beltway. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont, a bit under the weather, and we hope he gets well soon and comes right back. Joining us in the studio this evening, Mike Miller of DePaul University, Dave Lundy of Aileron Communications, John McGovern of Resolute Communications, and John McDonough of Northwestern University. We've chatted a lot about Obamacare. I want to get to some of the overseas issues, which have been brought to a head, I suppose, by this horrific circumstance down in Nairobi, Kenya, where the Shabib al-Qaeda affiliate, based loosely in Somalia, we understand, decided to take it upon itself to terrorize a shopping mall on the outskirts of Nairobi, Kenya, which is a stopping-off place for many Westerners who are based in East Africa. Very prominent Israeli-owned bakery and coffee shop presents to the public right there, but apparently they didn't target the Israelis down there at that coffee shop. But some 39 individuals at least have lost their lives. We understand the breaking news as we went on the air this evening is that almost all of the hostages have now been released, but police continue in the middle of the night over there in Nairobi to try and make sure that all of the terrorists have been apprehended or exterminated. What does this say, John McDonough, about the ongoing threat? And what does this say, not just about the United States and its posture towards the ongoing threat of terrorism, but, say, the Western world or the community of nations and its response to the ongoing threat?
Well, these kinds of attacks have been a part of our, you know, news culture for the last 35 years. And whether it's the Olympic, teams, or, I mean, they're unpredictable. The one thing, I mean, you tend to view it initially through the prism of some of the problems we've had with mass shootings in our own country. But the difference is, of course, that in the case of our own shootings, they tend to be one-off madmen who are doing it. Here, at least, there's a political rationale behind it, and so it's part of a larger political context in which these attacks take place. Mm-hmm. Terrible, but
it also shows
just the way of the world.
It shows the trouble with radical Islam. On the Drudge Report right before we came on the air, apparently a Christian church in Pakistan has been attacked and 71 are dead.
Mm-hmm.
If you're correct on the 36 in Kenya, multiply that by two now, and we have 71 dead in a church. Mm-hmm. They're at their house of worship, and they're killed by these people. Mm-hmm. The idea that somehow, I know that the war is over, I understand that, but the rise of radical Islam continues, and we have to mm-hmm. keep it under control.
Dave Lundy, Angela Merkel was reelected today, and she's been a supporter of a pretty forward position relative to global terrorism or international terrorism, and indeed Islamic mm-hmm. extremism. Does the international community have this right now?
Look, this this is an ongoing struggle. It is going to be an ongoing struggle. The fight between radical Islam and the West is going to continue throughout our lifetimes, unfortunately, yeah. throughout our children's lifetimes. You know, what's striking about this attack in Kenya is that before 9/11, you know, the first serious bin Laden attack was Nairobi, Kenya, where they brought down the towers and hundreds of people died. And unfortunately, even if you've dismantled the core, you know, Al-Qaeda has morphed into something that is horrific. And where you get into the real scary scenarios is if they get a hold of the Syrian chemical weapons, which is why what's happening in Syria is so important. If they get a hold of the Pakistani nuclear weapons, which is why the country that scares me the most in this world is Pakistan.
Well, I understand about Pakistan. We want to get to Iran in just a second. But John McGovern on the attack in Kenya.
You know, I was going to say to what Dave said, I mean, I'm not sure the core has been eliminated. I mean, I think it shows that Al-Qaeda is a enemy in and of itself that is aggressive. It's proactive. I mean, we saw what happened in Benghazi. We saw what happened. Obviously, we've been talking about what's happened in Nairobi. We see what's going on in Yemen and a number of other places. And it's just a different kind of enemy. And I think this goes back to the wars we've been fighting in the Middle East. And how to address that and attack that is much different than, say, a Syria or, you know, Afghanistan.
But there's also interesting, there's been this obvious tension between the Israelis, or I want to say the Jews and the Muslims over there. But now the Christians have been attacked in Egypt.
Yeah.
They were wiped out of Lebanon years ago.
Syria.
Now they're under attack in Syria. Now they're under attack in Pakistan. I just think this is a very sad development.
Well, and I think what's really scary is, you know, that's a very soft target, that mall. It was a very westernized right. type of shopping mall. I mean, that could happen here in the United States. And what's sure. particularly troubling is that apparently there are a lot of Ethiopians living in Minnesota, of all places, that are being targeted by the FBI
yeah.
that may or may not have connections with these groups. And, you know, again, how do you develop a strategy and a policy to deal with that?
You know, after 9/11, I expected that they were going to go after soft targets in the United States.
So did I.
And the fact that here we are.
And they tried. I believe it is the case that they tried, and they were thwarted in a variety of
But, I mean,
ways.
Someone walking into a Starbucks and blowing it up.
Oh, right.
I was expecting
you know,
it. Absolutely.
You know, something yeah. like that. I mean, that's.
And I think it's a testament to you know, some of the anti-terror policies of the Bush administration. I mean, you know, you can whenever my friends on the left want to hail Edward Snowden as a hero and attack everything the NSA does, I'm like, it's not a coincidence that we haven't had an attack in this country in the last 12 years. There are some important developments that have taken place, and they're uncomfortable. As a civil libertarian, they're really uncomfortable for me. But I really would prefer that we not blow up shopping malls in Des Moines.
Well, let's quickly ask about the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, who is going to be at the United Nations this week. When President Obama will be making his annual visit to the United Nations. And there, according to the Washington Post this morning, a clear trial balloon, they have left open the possibility of these two heads of government speaking with each other. Is John McDonough, is the time right for President Obama to speak with the new Iranian president?
I think probably so, because he has the Iranian Rouhani has certainly gone out of his way to reach out and put, you know, a contrasting message before the United States, and he is hoping, presumably, that the United States will respond. 8 or 9 years ago, there was a little blip of moderation in Iran, and it was, I think, pretty roundly rejected because it was coming so soon after, you know, 9/11 and all that sort of thing. We were not really in a position to, you know, make any concessions to Iran moderates. And
are you talking about that with the uprising by the people? That was during the, I'm going to say, the current administration, but we did nothing for
them.
No, this
was before Ahmadinejad and all that.
Oh, okay.
No,
I don't remember that.
But
Rouhani earned a meeting with the president of the United States based on the fact that he's been in office all of, I don't know, 80 days or something like that, and there haven't been any serious concessions by Iran.
Well, my understanding is that Rouhani's background suggests that he's a man who can be dealt with. Mm-hmm. And if we do sort of reach out and offer something that suggests we can deal with him, then that will enhance his authority
going back to Iran. John McGovern, does that make sense to you?
I think you make a good point, Chris. I mean, what has he done to open this line of communication other than to maybe say it's time to have a line of communication? And I think we just have to be very careful negotiating or even having a meeting with someone like that. I mean, look what happened with Putin and the president. I mean, who knows what they're going to use a meeting like that to press their own agenda. I mean, it may not be our agenda.
No, it's a cart before the horse, which is the – I mean, it's a cart horse thing. I mean, in order for him to give the United States something, he has to have the authority to persuade his own people to do it. He needs to have a little bit of the prestige of Obama to bring back.
But
to
I'm not sure
country.
I'm not sure we know how much control he really has over his own government.
We don't.
All right, Dave Lundy.
I actually think we know very much how much control he has over his own government. The answer is none.
Generally speaking, Zilcho.
Iran is governed by the mullahs. Correct. They decided who was allowed to run for president. They eliminated people who they were not comfortable with who were going to run for president. So they get to choose which of these candidates are going to run. Rouhani was one of the people that they chose as an okay guy to run. He has no power. Now, I think that's a different question of whether we should have a meeting, a presidential meeting. You know, I think he should meet with the Secretary of State when he's in the U.N. I think that would be totally appropriate. I'm not sure it would be appropriate for him to meet with Obama at this point. I don't know exactly what we're going to get out of that. And I just, you know, it's a very disturbing scenario because where does this go? I mean, if you can't negotiate with Rouhani, which you can't, then and you can't negotiate with the mullahs because they're not going to negotiate. No. Iran is controlled by hardliners. We saw that with the crackdown mm-hmm. on the street demonstrators years ago.
Yep. But the fact that the mullahs have in effect kind of sanctioned his administration by approving his presidency, does that tell you something about maybe
a
changing climate there?
I think what it is for the West.
And I also think it might say something about the impact that they are feeling from the sanctions. Which we're still sort of in sanctioned second gear. And United States Senator Mark Kirk has been pushing for sanctions in third or fourth gear for the last 7 years, and we still haven't gotten there. But
Iran has a lot to gain by dealing with this.
They have a lot to gain by adhering to global and international norms. So far, they're not. We'll talk more about that with our all-star panel after these words on Beyond the Beltway. Sunday evening from Chicago, it's Beyond the Beltway. Sitting in for Bruce Dumont, my name is Chris Roebling. Joined this evening by Mike Miller of DePaul University, John McGovern of Resolute Consulting, John McDonough, Northwestern University, and Dave Lundy, Aileron Communications. We've been chatting a lot about the international situation. Our phone number here is 1-800-723-8289 if you've got some quick points that you want to make about how the United States is faring in the world, how the world is doing itself. Please don't hesitate to give us a call. 800-723-8289. I want to say on this issue about the issue of radical Islam and what we are confronting. I think just moments ago we were saying it will be an issue for the rest of our lives and the lives of our children. I have come across a movie called Honor Diaries that will be premiering here in Chicago 2 weeks from tonight at the Chicago International Film Festival. And I urge everyone to take a look. Go onto the web, find Honor Diaries, and take a look. It is a film that brings together 11 Muslim women to talk about their experience in their societies. And these are 11 heroines of Islam and heroines standing up to talk about what is going on in Muslim communities around the world. It's called Honor Diaries. Please check it out. Premiering 2 weeks from tonight in Chicago at the International Film Festival here in Chicago. So let's chat for a second now about the strategic situation. We've touched on Syria, and Syria has been, I think, Bruce Dumont, Beyond the Beltway, devoted more time to Syria maybe than any other national radio phone and talk show.
Yeah,
the last two programs. But that means we've got to update the story. Mm-hmm. And so this week we saw Syria actually indicate some level of compliance. And I wonder if that gives us hope. Mike Miller, does that give us any kind of hope for this Russian brokered deal between Syria and the world at large, that we might actually see a reduction in the, or an elimination of the weapons of mass destruction that Syria has now admitted it holds?
I just don't see it. I always had a rule, I never trust a communist, because communists lie through their teeth. And I think this is just another version or a dictator who will say what he has to. If I thought for a second he was going to be like Gaddafi. Gaddafi actually said, I'm afraid I'm going to get rid of my arms and so forth, and it did fall apart in the end. But if I thought for a second that Assad was going to do that, I would think, yes. But I've been told, they know better than I do, that he's just an inveterate liar. And he was on the air today, and he asked all these questions. I just don't trust him. I'm sorry. What's the old thing about trust but verify? So let's verify that he's telling the truth. But you just don't trust dictators.
John McDonough, Bernard-Henri Lévy, did you see his piece this week? I should have asked you
no,
that.
No, I did not.
All right. Well, do you trust Bashar Assad?
It remains to be seen. What can we say? I mean, you don't trust him. That's fine. That's a reasonable position. I'm willing to, you know, let the situation play out and see what develops. Bush was Obama was kind of criticized for kind of playing this as if it was out of his control all the way. But I was thinking back to the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the little unexpected things that sort of helped us work our way through that just sort of came in spontaneously over the transom, like the back channel negotiation line that was set up through an ABC correspondent, John Scali.
Yeah.
And who could have predicted that? Well, you know, it came along at the right time. And, you know, maybe Kerry's offhanded remark at the, you know, who knows? Who knows how this is going to play out? All's well that ends well, I think, in a situation like this.
You're going to trust a man who gassed his own people.
It's not about trust. You can't trust.
You don't know it's going to end well either.
Well, let's hear from John McGovern and then Dave Lundy.
So this conversation is kind of premature. We're not historians
John
looking
McGovern,
back on
Henry Kissinger this morning said he anticipates 90% compliance and 10% deception.
Look, I don't trust Assad, but I think to the point that everyone jumped in, it's really not necessarily about trust. It's about, is something going to happen? Is there going to be some attempt to get these weapons out of his hands and somewhere else? I think what's really unfortunate about the whole thing is we now, as the United States, look like bystanders in the process. I think the president really mishandled the whole negotiation, allowing Putin to come in. Trust but verify is very important, but who's going to do the verification? I mean, is the U.S. going to be the one that's going to do the verification?
Why is it bad for Putin to come in? He's their most powerful patron. He has actual influence with Syria. We don't.
Putin has exhibited a steadfast interest in keeping a Syrian dictatorship planted firmly in the Mideast.
That's fine.
And he inherited that position from his KGB comrades, who could not get Gamal Abdel Nasser to be what, you know, Bashir's father, Hafez, said, I will be a puppet for you, Soviet Union. It's not just Nasser. I'll do it for you.
Well, we have a history of keeping our own dictators in power, and we don't have to go into that. But it's a game played by both sides.
Look, the question is, what is in his best interest? From his perspective, not ours, mm-hmm. What's in his best interest is to preserve his regime.
Absolutely.
The reason that he did this deal is because it was the chance to preserve his regime. He was afraid that he did not take us at our word, that John Kerry's word, that it was going to be a pinprick strike or anything like that. And as Barack Obama said, and it was
incredibly small.
We'll leave that aside.
What the heck does that mean?
We'll leave that aside for the moment. What we can say with some certainty is that Assad wants to preserve his position, and Putin wants to preserve Assad's
exactly.
position.
That's just as important.
So the question, though, is what is the United States' national interest in Syria? And clearly, number one, we can all agree that it's in the United States' interest to get rid of those chemical weapons, get them out of the hands of a country that is unstable as that.
Okay, but David, hold on. Before you go down that road,
okay, well, that was
if that
one.
Was, I know that was number one, but since it's number one, let me put you to that.
Yes.
If that was such a big deal, if I, a guy who wanders around reading the newspaper, if I knew that he had poisonous gas weapons, okay, I could have made that a much bigger issue years ago. I would not have been saying he's a reformer we can work with. I would not have ignored the December use of nerve agents against his own people, or the 11 or 12, depending on which international agency you listen to, intervening uses of nerve agents between December of 2012 and August 20th of 2013. So really, did the Barack Obama administration know its own mind on this question?
I think the Barack Obama administration has a problem with this, and the problem is very simple. The American people, members of Congress, members of the Senate, don't want to go near a Middle Eastern war with a 10-foot pole. Frankly, it was a weird tactical decision that the president made to go to Congress to get approval, because he never was going to get it. I didn't understand it at the time. I thought it was going to be a blunder, and Vladimir Putin parachutes in and saves his tushy, which allows for this agreement, which, if it happens, if it is executed, is in our best interest, and I'm not sure where we can go from there.
All right, let's listen to Ray. He is listening on KTSM in Sun City, El Paso, Texas. Ray, let's hear from you. Your bottom line point, please. Oh, Ray is gone. Okay, sorry. We missed out on Ray. There was a cloud that obscured the sun down in El Paso. Lloyd in Waynesville, North Carolina, listening on the great WAPI. Lloyd, your position on the Syrian question.
Actually, I have two questions, if your panel doesn't mind.
Real quick.
The first one is, it's my understanding that the Soviet Union has Syria owes them an awful lot of money, so there's a strong financial incentive for the two of them to remain involved with one another. But the other thing I also wanted to talk to real quick was in regards to your earlier conversation regarding Al-Qaeda. It seems to me that one of the things the world should be looking at in general is doing something about the economic prosperity of some of these people and better education, because as long as they remain poor and without education, they're going to be ripe for the picking by some of these extremist groups.
Lloyd,
and
thank
I'll
you.
I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, Lloyd of Waynesville, North Carolina, listening on WAPI.
A lot of those Islamists are not poor people. And I am lucky enough to teach in the country of Bahrain in the Middle East. And that is certainly a middle-class country, if I could use that expression. And their problems are between the Sunni and the Shia. So I go over there, and I oftentimes wonder how we could be at war with Islam. We're not. We're at war with radical Islam, because I interact with such wonderful people. But they don't get along. There's fighting in the street almost a daily basis between the Shia, who are the majority people, but the king is a Sunni.
But
they don't get along.
Let me follow up on the caller's point about economic integration and the fact that, for whatever reason, you know, the United States and the world community looked the other way while these countries were under various despots and dictators. Mm-hmm. And there aren't very many opportunities for the young people in Egypt, or for the young people in Syria, for that matter. Those economies have been ignored and neglected, or they've been dominated by oil in some cases, with very little getting to the rank and file, to the average people. What are the prospects for increasing income and employment and wealth creation?
I think a lot of it has to do with education. I think you see much more. Dave was saying his biggest fear in that part of the world is going to be Pakistan. I happen to agree with him. And one reason I think that is true is because there's a huge number of people in Pakistan who are, to use the word, uneducated. They don't read. They only hear what is taught to them in a vocal sense. And the countries that are doing, like I say, I've been in Bahrain, this is an educated population. And they're battling between each other, but they're handling it better than average.
In Bahrain, you called it a middle-class country.
Yes.
So are you suggesting that the distribution of wealth is reasonably
equitable?
Oh, no,
there is a huge middle class. The people, they are reasonably well off.
So it's a solid middle class country.
Oh, yeah, but the king and his people are worth billions and billions of dollars.
You think wealth distribution is an issue in Pakistan, then? In addition to educational
distribution. Education is a distribution problem.
Does economic distribution sort of follow from that, then?
Yeah, I think so. Right. I think it's... people can be entrepreneurs and so forth. And one thing that Bahrain does, they're like number 11 in the country and in the world in openness.
It's time for a break. You're listening to Beyond the Beltway. I'm sitting in for Bruce Dumont. My name is Chris Roebling, and we'll see you in a few minutes. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway, thanking my all-star panel tonight, Mike Miller of DePaul University, Dave Lundy of Aileron Communications, John McGovern of Resolute Consulting, and John McDonough of Northwestern University. Thank you, one. Thank you all. Thank you also, callers, listeners and callers. We got most of you on the air tonight, not all, but we appreciate everybody who dials in with an important or pertinent observation. In this last segment, John McDonough brought us a very challenging topic and a very interesting one, given an upcoming anniversary. John.
Well, last week, John Stewart did a pretty serious takedown of CNN for the way it covered the Naval Yard massacre last week. And in covering the breaking news, all the inaccuracies they managed to weave into their coverage. And today on the media, I noticed...
On the media, an
NPR program,
radio program,
heard
listen sometime,
comes from WNYC in New York. They analyzed the press, and they took a somewhat different tack, but they did a piece in which they warned people how to beware that coverage was suspect. And I kind of my own personal reaction was not to really kind of join into this piling on the media, because I think when the media is covering a breaking story, and I mean when I say the media, I mean television and radio, mm-hmm. broadcast, mm-hmm. They are sort of giving you everything the moment it comes in. It's an entirely different discipline from a newspaper or Time magazine or the print media, which tends to filter mm-hmm. A bit more before it gets to the public. And I remember doing a piece many years ago on the moment-to-moment coverage of D-Day in June of 1944, which was the first time a broadcast ever really attempted to cover a breaking story, you know, second by second, minute by minute. And there were inaccuracies there, too, because of the sources they were reporting from. It was incomplete, and the listener got a sense of that incompleteness until it started to fill in. And that the one thing about radio and television is when you realize you're wrong, you can instantly correct yourself.
But the anniversary that we cite, of course, is
Kennedy.
November 22nd, yeah. 1963, the Kennedy assassination. When breaking news was never more important, and when the broadcast media did a pretty good job of only going with what it could confirm, wouldn't we agree?
I absolutely agree. And I think the one problem I have, I saw that piece by Stewart and so forth, and mm-hmm. it was entertaining, as he usually is. My only comment is that I think there's an underlying theme, though, especially when it was something like a shooting. It was the invariable. They were going to bring up somehow an AR-15. They were going to bring up an assault rifle, and they were going to stuff it in there somehow or other. And it just happens. I don't know why they have to do that. Why they have to make that mistake
over and over. When you say they, you're referring to CNN.
Yes, that somehow they're going to push that into the discussion.
Dave Lundy, was CNN loading its coverage because of political preferences relative to gun control agendas?
Look, I think it's a logical question. When somebody shoots up a naval base, whether an AR-15 was used, they may have made assumptions. Why is it logical?
I don't understand why it would be logical.
That you would use an assault weapon when you're conducting that kind of an assault on
well,
a civilian population?
Well, I mean, you could use a rifle. Because that's all it is a rifle.
But you're not going to use a rifle if you're trying to give a mass shooting. I mean,
this is actually a relatively small rifle. It's not like a hunting rifle.
No, all right, but let me get back.
But the point,
the nature of what the attack was, it could have been a handgun. Somebody could.
It was. It was a shotgun.
Did bias about gun control influence coverage?
Look, I think your core question was about CNN's coverage, and I saw the John Stewart piece too, and it was very funny. But I think John Stewart's bigger point was the breathless nature of CNN's idiotic coverage of this and many, many, many incidents. I mean, it boggles the mind. I wish CNN would fix itself.
Yes,
so whether there's somebody had some notion that an assault weapon. The fact is, there have been a lot of mass shootings where assault weapons were used. Okay, sorry.
But I mean, let's be honest. I mean, mean, I think there's a bigger...
We're not confronting the gun culture here.
There's a bigger issue about this, and I think it's not just CNN. I mean, it's given the media world as it exists today, there is this dramatic pressure to break and be first and be out there, and with Twitter and all the social media and all the other outlets that are now, you know, readily available to everyone, that the news organizations, I think they lose some of their checks and balances because they're so desperate to get out there.
There's one other change in the media since the days of the Kennedy assassination and D-Day and all that. Today, with networks on the air devoted entirely to news, you have pundit-driven news coverage. In the case of the Kennedy assassination, when you look at the original kinescopes, most of the reporting that was done was being done by reporters who were on the scene or close to the scene. In CNN and Fox and MSNBC, you have reporters feeding, you know, to some extent, that coverage, but it's the consumer is really the pundit who takes all that and kind of reinterprets it and uses their imagination. And I think that's why sometimes the coverage gets.
I will say, as a former
speculative
radio news anchor at an all news radio station, WMAQ, of dear departed memory, but I was alone as the anchor during the Columbine shootings. My co-anchor, John Dempsey, was on his honeymoon, God bless him, and he and Eileen were having a great time, and I was back there trying to make WMAQ sound reasonable. And I can tell you, as a former anchor in that situation, no one is more dependent in the entire world than a news anchor in a breaking news situation, because you are you feel absolutely cemented to your chair and to your microphone, and you have no idea what's going on except what people are telling you. And if it's a pundit who's telling somebody what's going on, that's got to be discounted as coming from a pundit as opposed to a reporter, a real reporter.
Yeah, I guess I...
And add to that, like, Twitter feeds and, you know, all the other,
you've got reporters doing Twitter feeds before they're on the air.
Sure.
That is an inversion of the world as we know it. And on that happy note, thank you to Mike Miller of DePaul University, John McDonough of Northwestern University, John McGovern of Resolute Consulting, and Dave Lundy of Aileron Communications. My guests, those terrific guests, have done a great job. The program itself is a production of Genevieve Productions in association with WLS Radio here in Chicago. I want to thank Fritz Goldman, Dan Dorfman, Tom Vercruz, who've helped make this entire program possible. Sitting in for Bruce Dumont, my name is Chris Roebling, and we hope he's back real soon. Thanks for joining us from Chicago.